Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 29th, 1996. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jack Evert. Today's session number is 1 and is titled, Why We Don't Pray. Let's listen in.
Jack Evert, and the title I picked, Why We Don't Pray. The director said this morning, there's an assumption there, or said at lunchtime. So basically what I wanted to do was to share with you what my process has been as my prayer life has increased. In other words, basically what's been the struggles or barriers or kind of hindrances to developing a prayer life for myself. And then I'm a pastoral counselor and CPE supervisory candidate, which basically means I supervise seminary students. So as I've worked with people in 12-step programs where meditations is a big part of their recovery, or I've supervised seminary students, and sometimes when they talk about goals, we always ask them, what do you want to have as a goal? Often they'll say, well, I want to increase my prayer life. So there's, you know, different contexts in which I've worked with people around their approach to prayer. Once again, I have kind of a psychological background, and so I have certain training and certain populations that I work with that kind of influence my experience. So what I have to say may not apply to everybody or across the board. It's just my experience. And then I'm hoping that I'll learn from this group, in other words, that part of what we may use the time for is to say what's been a barrier for you, or what do you see as a barrier, or how have you moved through certain barriers or stages to kind of increase your prayer life. So let me start by saying one other thing. I think my goal for a prayer life for myself is really to practice the presence of God in my life. I don't know that I necessarily pray to change others or change myself, but for me it's kind of a participatory practice. Now, while I'm in the presence of God or working with that kind of idea, there's a certain content to it. There's certain things that I pray or certain things that come to mind, but I don't know that that's necessarily the objective for me anyways. I thought that I would read a passage in Mark that kind of came up in the Bible study the other day. And I took a little different spin on it than the person who was reading the Bible study, but since this is my group, I can kind of present my spin on it. It has to do with Jesus and the disciples and the experience at Gethsemane. This is from Mark. And they went to a place which was called Gethsemane, and he said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." And he took with him Peter and James and John and began to be greatly distressed and troubled. And he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch." And going a little further, he fell on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, "Abba, Father, all things are possible to thee. Remove this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." And he came forward and found them sleeping. And he said to Peter, "Simon, are you asleep? Could you not watch 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." And again he went away and prayed, saying the same words. And again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were very heavy, and they did not know what to answer him. And he came the third time and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and taking your rest? It is enough. The hour has come. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand. This is Mark 14, verses 32 through 42. To me, that story contains a lot of the drama around prayer that we'll kind of talk about. I think prayer, the fact that Jesus took time to pray, that's one thing. Secondly, that in the time that he took to pray, he got upset. You know, that he had upsetting feelings that came to him. And then I think the fact that the disciples didn't pray and in essence couldn't really get on board with him around this, I hear his frustration not as kind of criticizing the disciples, but kind of criticizing the way the world is. You know, in other words, for him, I think it was a process of acceptance and reconciliation. And I think that's part of what happens in prayer. So in essence, Jesus kept going back and saying, can't you guys stay awake? You know, I mean, I think there's this frustration that they just couldn't be with him. And I don't know that this translation communicates it so well, but I think at some point he kind of let go of it and said, it's time to move on. You know, I can't get, you know, so bent out of shape, you know, about this. And I think he was kind of on about other things that he was doing. And so I don't necessarily think, I mean, the way it was presented the other day had more to do with how the disciples kept falling short. And, you know, that somehow we should be even better than the disciples. At least I hear even better. I think, you know, that's kind of a high standard. I mean, usually we say, well, we fall short of Christ, but maybe we can get better than the disciples, seems to be some of the implication. But I think the disciples' experience is much more true to our experience in terms of prayer and how we relate to it. Let me talk a little bit and present some of these points, and then we can come back and talk a little bit more about them. I think... Well, I'll talk about my experience before I make some of the observations. I don't think I ever prayed privately, or I, not that I was aware of, for until I became an adult. I think most of my prayers were kind of said in the midst of a community. I'm sure that my parents encouraged me to pray as a child, but I don't really remember that being, you know, kind of part of my experience per se. It's not something that I took with me. So I didn't, you know, I guess I didn't really start to think much about prayer until I was in my 30s. And this was, you know, after I'd gone through seminary and things like that. And I mean, in terms of a real kind of important level. Part of what happened with me was I started to realize as I, you could say, went into midlife kinds of things for men or adults, that I was much more of an introvert, and that in order for me to really mature, I needed to develop and start to trust my own sense of interior calling or hunches or intuition. And I'm a potter, and when you make something in pottery, you have one hand on the inside and one on the outside. And to me, that's an important metaphor. So for me, there's the community on the outside and personal prayer life on the inside. And that somehow these two have to work together in order to create something. So for me, I had the exterior hand, but I didn't really have the interior hand. And just like in pottery, what happens is, if you're creating something, you take that inside hand out, you feel a lot of pressure. You know, things collapse on you because you're always responding to the exterior. So in the process of developing that interior life, and for me that was a discovery in terms of being an artist and being more creative, and trusting myself more, believing that God lives within me as well as around me, like the two hands. So part of that process was to look at my prayer life as a way of getting in touch with my intuition, the God within me. So all of that kind of peace started developing pretty much the same time. In the Myers-Briggs, which is kind of a personality type of indicator, you know, I'm an INFP, which basically means if I have an idea or something happens, I slow down and think about it. I used to work with what's called ENFPs, in other words, people who get a lot of energy from groups. And so we'd have an idea, I would want to slow down and think about it, and they'd want to speed up and do it. And as you read more about difference between introverts and extroverts, introverts, at least some of the stuff I've been reading, introverts tend to easily get overstimulated, so they're constantly slowing things down. Extroverts are, give me more, you know, you got to give me more. And so as I'm dealing with my own introverted nature and slowing down, then the issue around prayer, you know, becomes more important and more of a resource. And then also in the last year or so, I've moved more into a Quaker community. I'm a Lutheran pastor, but as I've started to kind of explore some of this, I've moved into a Quaker community in Chicago, and that's a big, you know, that's a big change. I mean, they have no liturgy. You know, silence is their liturgy, and so you walk in and it's quiet, nothing. I mean, if someone feels moved out of the quiet to stand up and to sing or to read something, that's certainly happens, but you could be there an hour and no one would say anything. And sometimes there'll be two or three people that'll kind of come out of the silence and feel called to speak and to say something that's on their mind. So that's a very different style of worship than the liturgy that I also lead as a Lutheran pastor, that I kind of describe as dancing, you know, this movement and, you know, this kind of flow as a group. So it's a very different kinds of orientation. So I've moved, or I'm moving into embracing the part of me that enjoys the Quaker kind of style of worship and prayer. So that's a little bit about my kind of journey. So it's ongoing, and like I said, it's very much informed by my personality and some other situations out of my life that, you know, you may have some similarities or not. The first way I got into talking about this as a topic about prayer, it just kind of struck me, why wouldn't people want to pray? You know, I mean, if you say prayer is great, what's the problem? You know, why is it difficult to, you know, find the time to pray? And basically, time became the first insight that came to me, was that if people had the time, that's what I hear the most. You know, if I had the time, I would pray. So it's kind of like nobody has any problems with prayer, or at least not that we talk about. The problems have to do with how do we find the time to pray. So that was the first kind of barrier that I thought about, both for myself and what I was hearing for other people, had to do with time. How do you find the time to pray? The second thought that came to me was that our time, like our money, is all spent. So in essence, if you are going to give me 15 minutes every day or a half an hour every day, let's use that kind of extreme example, then you'd have to make some changes. Like your money, you know, if you were gonna give me $1,000, you'd have to say, you know, I'm gonna have to quit doing this, I'm gonna have to sell this, I'm gonna have to take it from here, and there'd have to be changes in order to free up a set amount of money. And I think our time is that way. So the next thing that I started thinking about was, well, then it's a loss issue in a way, Because if you are spending your time the way you want to spend it, right now, you're spending your time the way you want to spend it, and you have to change, then something, you're going to have to let go of something. You're going to have to, or I'm going to have to get up earlier in the morning, which means I'd get less sleep. Might mean that I would not read the paper every day. It might mean that I might not go to work at 7:30 and go at 8. So that it may mean I'd get something less done at work. It may mean, it may impact the relationships in my family. It may mean, you know, I cook less, or I take turn, or I get somebody else to cook more, or so. I mean, you know, somehow I started thinking that there's impact of any decision that we might make to free up a half an hour or 20 minutes. And that might be something for you just to think about. You know, if you were going to do that, hypothetically, what would you have to give up in your life, or what changes would you have to make in order to do that? And people might say, well, I wouldn't really have to give up anything. Maybe I just have to be more intentional. But see, I think we get some pleasure out of not having to be intentional. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe we have to be intentional at work, and maybe what we want to do is to not have to schedule our time. And so what you would lose is the freedom to not pay attention to the time. And only if you can recognize what the loss might be, could you then, I think, more responsibly make a decision, yes, I'm going to give up this and do this. So I think there's some issues around time, and I think it's important to think about it as a loss issue, because that would explain why it's so difficult to let it go, because there's consequences for it, and the burden of those consequences might be too great, you know, whatever that would be kind of spelled out. The other thing that I wanted to say about this point had to do with turning things over, because that's also a way to deal with the loss, is to use the prayer time to turn over what you can't get done because you're spending the time doing this. So once again, using an analogy with money, or even Sabbath, maybe that's a good, better context. Whether you talk about tithing or whether you talk about Sabbath, to me, those are also healthy limitations. So in other words, if you have $100 and you spend 90 of it, then you've got $10 that will allow you to absorb the ebb and flow of life. And you've got some slack. If you've got 100 hours to work and you work 90, you've got a little time in there to allow for things that might happen and to rest and to allow for some integration. If you have $100 and you spend $100, you're tight. I mean, you're up against the wall. Something happens, you know, you're up the creek without a paddle, so to speak. So in some ways, whether you talk about tithing, praying, or Sabbath, I think it's an opportunity to get some feedback about whether we've overextended ourselves. In other words, have we scheduled too many things in our life? Have we taken on one too many tasks? Have we, you know, agreed to do one too many things? Are we expecting too much of ourselves? So it could be a little bit of a barometer that can help us. So basically, I'm not trying to say we should pray every day. I'm not trying to say we should pray for half an hour. That's really not my point. My point is there might be some ways that maintaining this practice might make other parts of our life better, because they would make us make some changes in our life that we might benefit from. That's my assumption. And then I have a little prayer that I used to use to turn things over. I actually used it when I was a chaplain in an intensive care unit. And I used to, the only image I have, I used to approach working in the intensive care unit like swimming underwater. I'd come up the intensive care unit and I'd take a deep breath and I'd go in and I'd see people and then I'd run out. You know, because I couldn't deal with the loss and the sadness. And so finally, you know, my supervisor said, Jack, you gotta, or you could just sit there and see what it feels like to be in there. And so what it felt like was I was taking on the sadness, but I didn't know what to do with it. So I started writing names of people and also myself in a turning over prayer. And I use the one that's in the which is in the funeral service. Some of you may recognize it. Into your hands, O merciful Savior, I change it. I used to change it. We commend your servant, thus and such. Acknowledge, we humbly beseech you, a sheep of your own fold, a lamb of your own flock, a sinner of your own redeeming. Receive them into the arms of your mercy. So, in essence, you know, I'd have these families and I'd want to go home at night and not worry about it. Or I'd have this task that I wasn't able to get done. So I would take this prayer and at the end of the day or whenever I was leaving, then in essence turn it over to God. And the prayer by saying, you know, into your hands, O Lord, so you're turning it over to God, but you're also saying a sheep of your own fold. That's really kind of a reminder. Whose responsibility is it? It's not my sheep. I'm willing to be a servant and work with this family, but I'm not the one that promised that I could be there for them. God made that promise. Now, I'm certainly willing to be raised up to be there, but it's not me that's the promise maker. And so that prayer kind of reminds me, Jack, you're not the one who said you'd take care of all this. You do your part. And so that kind of helps me get centered. So that's the prayer that I use, you know, to turn over things. So so that's that. I want to stop at this point and just ask, is this, you know, am I making sense? You get a kind of understand where I'm heading with this. And any kind of questions or comments?
I'd like to hear you say more about being aware of the presence of God. I was thinking of that little book by Brother Lawrence, you know, The Practice of the Presence of God, which I've read, and I found that quite wonderful. Mm-hmm. What techniques do you use, or do you empty your mind, or what do you do?
Well, we're going to be talking about that in just a little bit.
Oh, okay.
So in terms of you know, what I do. Basically, I do what's kind of breath prayers, and I have a way of picking just simple phrases as a way of focusing. But I'll be talking about that in a minute.
Richard Foster has a wonderful quote in Celebration of Discipline.
Oh, uh-huh.
About Luther, from Luther. Unfortunately, he didn't give the source, but it goes something like Luther saying, if I didn't pray for 3 hours every morning, I'd never get everything done that I need to get done.
And what do you think he meant by that?
Well, I think he meant by that prayer was an important aspect of his life that empowered him to accomplish what he needed to accomplish in his day, in his 24-hour period. And, you know, as much as I've worked with prayer myself and with people and on the issue of praying, I don't think time is the issue.
Okay.
I think there's some other things that are sort of deeper than that.
Okay.
And that if we really want to answer that call, call to prayer, that gift of prayer, we will find the time. The time will be there for us.
Okay. Well, we may, like I said, at the end we may, you know, I'd be interested in hearing some other, you know, people's experience in terms of what some of the barriers might be. Well, let me go on because some of it will touch on some of these questions. The next issue that I found to be difficult and heard as a struggle for people was what I kind of label as just mind wanders. And some people don't feel comfortable with that. And sometimes what it wanders about is upsetting. So the question I have is, why would we want things to keep going over and over again in our minds? Things that upset us or things that are a problem for us? Or why would we want to experience certain emotions such as anger so intimately? So in other words, when Jesus went up to Gethsemane, that's basically what he had, a very intimate experience with anger, with his emotions about this particular challenge that he faced. I mean, it's a very powerful statement. You know, remove this cup from me. But on one hand, he's saying, not my will, but yours. But on the other hand, it's like, and that must have been difficult just to be so conflicted about it. Now, according to the story, it kind of implies he went up back and forth. So he must have been thinking about the same thing each time. I mean, in terms of this struggle going around, you know, within him. The analogy that I use is that it's kind of like a moth in the jar. And in some ways, this is where I would have went with Luther's comment, but I haven't read that much about the background. But it's like if I don't let the moth out, it just bats against the wall all day. And so in essence, I'm not very focused and very clear-minded because I'm carrying certain burdens through the day. So things are on my mind or I'm aware of something. But what I found is when I take time to pray, it lets out that emotion or that worry or that thought, and then I don't have it the rest of the day. And because I'm not carrying it the rest of the day, I can be more mindful of what it is I'm doing at other times during the day. If I'm carrying the worry, then I'm working on this project, but rather than finishing the project, my mind starts to wander. And I'm not, you know, and all of a sudden I think I'm reading this book, and then I'm starting to think about, you know, what's going on with my son or some other problem, and then all of a sudden I'm not, you know, I'm not getting anything read because my mind's wandering, and so I'm not getting much accomplished. So there's a way in which prayer time for me makes me feel more efficient at what I have to do during the day, and I feel less preoccupied or sidetracked by other kinds of worries or problems that I have. So that in essence it's like letting the moth out of the jar for me. It's like prayer time is the time to deal with things or to raise things and with the idea of then releasing them and then going about the day feeling better, being a little bit more clear in my mind. I started this process for me. Other people, or there's other folks who call it a breath prayer, but let me tell you what my understanding of my breath prayer is. Basically, I just take a simple phrase and I connect it to my breathing. And I will often read meditation books, 12-step meditation books. One that I recommend is called Each Day a New Beginning, or Days of Healing, Days of Joy. And then I just pick one phrase out of that reading, and I connect it to my breathing. So one phrase I've chosen in the past is, calm requires complete trust. So I would inhale, I'd sit flat, put my feet flat, and I'd inhale and say calm, and then exhale, requires complete trust. And then I would just focus on that phrase until I could get it kind of connected to my breathing. Then I would allow certain things that I worried about to come in between the phrase and see if the phrase couldn't inform my problem. So I would inhale and say, calm concerning work, exhale, requires complete trust. Or calm concerning my son, exhale, requires complete trust. Then I began to realize that's why I was anxious, because I wasn't trusting. You know, and I began to kind of, so the phrase ended up kind of informing my experience, and in that sense, helped me. And then I would run my kind of inventory through the phrase, whatever I was thinking about, you know, I would do that. And the nice thing about that phrase, or in that process for me, is I could do it anywhere. I mean, if I was sitting at supper and I decided I needed to get centered, you know, I could connect it to my breathing, I could slow down and remind myself that calm requires complete trust. When I used to go to lead retreats on prayer and meditation, people would bring like a whole stack of meditation books. And, you know, we kind of go around and people would read this meditation for the day from this book and this meditation from this. And I just felt, once again, I'm an introvert, I felt overstimulated. And so then I started thinking what would be helpful in prayer is to have some focus and to pick just one verse, one phrase out of the reading. Now, and then I used to keep track of the phrases that I would choose, too, just to see kind of over a period of time if there was a theme that would begin to emerge. The other benefit of this kind of prayer, and I'm not saying, I mean, I'm fine with when my mind wanders, but when you have a phrase, if all of a sudden you find yourself thinking about something and you say, well, I want to stop that, thinking about that, then you've got a phrase to go back to kind of refocus yourself. You've got some touchstone to do that. Then the other thing is, I think the breathing process, inhaling and exhaling, there's a way that the exhaling for me is kind of the turning over part of the phrase. So I've used just phrases. I've used, when I've prayed the kind of daily lectionary series, you can pick phrases out of scripture. You know, to me, that model, you can use any kind of book or anything like that for some kind of resource or some kind of reference point. Is that helpful? I think the other thing is, I put down in my notes here, acceptance. I think for me, part of the value of prayer is helping me to accept the world as it is. That part of my biggest struggle is either I want to be different or I want the world to be different. And I don't have, you know, great success in either one of those, you know, areas. I mean, I can make certainly more changes than I can impact in the world, but for the most part, you know, I'm kind of the way I am, and you know, it's just little changes around the edges, but for the most part, you know, my struggles are going to be with me, just like my gifts, hopefully. So some of the process is also some reconciliation process, some acceptance process. And I think that's what Jesus was about in the prayer in Gethsemane. He was about accepting a process to accept what he saw coming and also accepting his disciples. You know, whether it was the crucifixion or sleeping disciples, you know, Christ was looking around and kind of, in essence, saying, I wish things were different than they were, but they're not. And it's your will, God, not mine. So I think there's an acceptance, a goal of acceptance, that's part of the process of prayer. For those of you that have come in. I'm basically talking about some blocks to prayer, some barriers, kind of based on my experience. It's not like I've read a lot about prayer or had a broad sweep, but basically sharing some things within my experience. We talked about time being one of the issues at first. From my experience, how do you find the time to pray? And encourage people to look at that like a loss issue. What do you have to give up in order to set the time aside? Any response to the issue about mind wandering and kind of being like a moth in the jar and things batting around? And that's...
I tend to associate that problem with meditation, and I guess I tend to think they're two different things, meditation and prayer. And the things you're saying, sounds like you blend them.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I think we can talk about that, because there's some issues that I feel unfinished about myself in terms of prayer. And, you know. Well, the next one I put down had to do with anxiety response. More is better and busier is better. And I came up on this phrase one time in my reading, when the calm is broken, be alone with God. That was a totally new concept to me. I thought when the calm was broken, you got on the phone, or you ran around, or you found out what is the problem here. Or your mind raced and you said, how do I change this? What do I do next? I never associated the brokenness of calm with slowing down or being alone. I went exactly the opposite. I mean, I was so struck by that, I just couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, so in some ways these breath prayers have been like a re-education for me. It's like, Jack, no wonder things are crazy. You got it all wrong, you know? You're running off when you should be slowing down. You're not trusting when you should be trusting. And so it's almost as if in this process, you know, I've had to, you know, really learn that my thinking has not helped me, you know, in terms of just, you know, living and a response. So obviously, once again, that's where prayer would come in, because, you know, that's what you could do when you slow down. But I also think that's part of the barrier, is dealing with the anxiety of what if you're not running off dealing with this problem? You know, what if you can't fix it? You know, what if the letter isn't going to get there quick enough? What if this is something you need to let go of rather than spend the extra time doing it? So there's a way in which there is some anxiety that gets in the way, and you might ask yourself, when you're anxious, what do you do? Do you slow down, or do you get busy and busy yourself? And or I might busy myself even eating or drinking or something like that. I'm anxious, you know, I'll go do something or get something. Or so there's some ways in which we've gotten used to dealing with anxiety that may not, you know, that may be a barrier, because if we're busy worrying or anxious, that it uses our time up. The other thing that I don't know what to make of this necessarily, but sometimes people don't have a place to pray, or they don't feel safe. They don't have a safe place to pray. And, you know, I'm kind of hoping that's not so much of an issue for this group. The very fact that you came here means that you make some choices about a safe place. So, in essence, you know, whether the safe place is a place to vacation or step out of, you're probably making good choices about that. But some of the people that I work with, they, you know, if I said, where would you go to pray? They'd just say, I don't know where I would go to pray. I remember when that kind of struck me, I know that I always, you know, my brother was my roommate, and I started thinking, I don't really have a place. So the next time my family moved, I said that we would get a three-bedroom house instead of a two-bedroom house, and that one room would be for prayer, you know, meditation would be would be my place. And everybody said, fine, you know. So we did. We bought a house. We got a three-bedroom house. And I remember when I had this room, early on in the discussion, it was kind of like, well, my folks are coming. Can they sleep in that place? And I said, no, they can't. You know, that's not, you know, that's not a place for people to be moving through. That's a place where if I want to go, that's, you know, that's my place. Now, like I said, I'm not saying that you need to claim that kind of place or space in your house or in your life, but you might ask yourself, if I was to pray for 15 minutes or a half an hour, you know, where could I go? Where could I go that I wouldn't be bothered? Where could I go that I wouldn't be self-conscious? Where could I go that I would reap the accumulative benefits of always going to that place? One of the things I did is I had a chair that I'd always sit in. And I wouldn't sit in that chair unless I was praying. But the minute I sat in that chair, I felt prayerful. I mean, it kind of got me into the mood and into the place. And that chair is still, like I said, it's hard for me to sit in that chair if I'm not praying. I mean, I almost feel like I'm violating this kind of sacred place because, you know, so much that's been important to me, I've wrestled with in that particular chair. Yeah.
I was going to say, for me in my life, just in the last year, my place has become my word processor.
Oh. Huh.
And I've put it on password protect and a whole bit in my office. So like the first half hour of every day, I'm on the word processing, and it's become my prayer journal. Huh. So when I came up here last week, I figured I'd use this as a prayer journal, and I did it one day, and then my place has become on the way to Turmel Creek and back.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's kind of like a different atmosphere, different time, and I just haven't had the need to record it.
Yeah.
But that's been a significant change in my life in the last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of the reason I'm holding this up once again in terms of a barrier is that the lack of seeing either a walk or a computer or a chair or something can be something that could make prayer less inviting. But if you found something that you do. See, walking would be good because it's rhythm, and any kind of rhythm motion is something that kind of allows your mind to be kind of freed up to meditate. And as I was, like I said, this has really struck me when I was doing meditations with people, guided imagery, and I'd have them, first of all, image themselves in a safe place, and people would be done the exercise, and they'd say, I couldn't, you know, I didn't know where a safe place was. Or it's real sad when kids would say, well, my safe place is this closet, or my safe place is under the bed, or, you know, then you really get anxious. And children who were abused, sexually abused, would have images of tremendously safe places, like the top of a 99-story building with no elevators and no windows, or in a submarine at the bottom of the ocean. I used to journal, I mean, I've kept track of all these images of people's safe places. And it's important to feel safe. Most people, they might say, my safe place is my bedroom, or, you know, maybe with someone or whatever, not quite so dramatic, but it's just to say that a safe place it's important in this process.
Your comment about the, what was it, when the calm is broken, be alone with God.
Mm-hmm.
Was another phrase that stopped me. They said, don't just do something, stand there.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's what I had to do in the intensive care unit here.
know, just because my supervisor said, just sit on the unit. Don't be running around. You know, just sit there and see, feel those feelings. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let me just make the last point. And what I put down here is, how does our understanding of God impact our willingness to improve our conscious contact or our desire to know God's will, I say for us, or our willingness to approach God for courage? This would be a time when maybe our understanding of God, even if it's an unconscious understanding of God, is also a barrier. Maybe we don't see God as the kind of God that's intimately involved in our life. And so what would we, I hate to phrase it this way, but what would we want to pray for? In other words, sometimes God is viewed by us emotionally like a movie critic. You know, somebody who's out there watching and the film's rolling, been produced, and God's looking and you know, get a 3-star rating or a 4-star rating or whatever. Now, maybe that's theologically whatever we want to say about it, but sometimes that's how we operate out of our gut, and so we don't really think about how God is involved in our life. So if we have that kind of understanding of God, then, you know, we might put out a prayer or something, but it feels more like something put out. For me, in this process, I changed my understanding of God. I really moved more clearly into understanding God as a potter, as a creator. And so in that image, a potter is definitely intimately hands-on involved in the creation of the pot. So when in Isaiah it says, you know, I'm the clay, you're the potter, I don't think about it, me being this inanimate object that has no whatever, but I think about that relationship and I think about the intimacy. When you think about the intimacy, then it makes praying and it makes the possibility of God, of experiencing God's presence more real. If I'm thinking that God is, for me, this wouldn't be as positive an image, Father, who is somewhat detached, more kind of, at least part of what I associate with Father is, you know, the one who's going to give you direction or discipline or whatever. But it's there's still some distance there. And so my understanding of God is impacted, you know, how that process goes. So then I believe it's much more easier for me to believe, yeah, when I set the time aside, when I do this, I'll feel that connection, that intimacy. Then I basically talked about, like I said, our experience with authority, our experience with our fathers, and how that might influence what we operate out of more than actually a more differentiated understanding of God and what, you know, what that might mean for us. Then I put down some of what's really influenced my understanding of prayer and my wrestling with the certain barriers for me was the 12 steps of AA. And they really don't have too many prayers in AA. And the step 11 says, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood God, praying only for the knowledge of God's will for us and the power to carry it out. And that's really powerful. I mean, if I think about it, those are the major struggles for me. Either I don't know what to do, or I'm scared to do it. So if I don't know what to do, then I need to slow down and say, yeah, this is what I need to do. And if I'm scared, then I need to slow down to pray for the courage because, yeah, this is the decision I know I've got to make. I'm just avoiding it. You know, or I don't want to make the changes necessary. Or I'm anxious about the losses that are going to be involved if I do this versus that. So to me, just thinking about knowledge and courage, that's a lot. Which leads me to the part of prayer that feels unfinished for me. Maybe at some other point I'll give a workshop and I'll have some answers. But this whole idea of, you know, ask for what you want, you're going to get it. You know, I mean, it's very clear in Scripture. You know, there is that, but I always get anxious because I think that's where I get into my old, oh, you mean I can get what I want kind of thing. I don't know how to find the balance yet around asking and receiving. You know, knock and the doors will be open. I mean, I think in some ways what I've learned in my life is that I have received what I wanted. God's timing has been terrible from my perspective. So, you know, I've seen the things that my heart has hoped for come to me. But it's usually 3 to 4 years later. So I'm getting a little better about saying, yeah, I can wait, because in some ways I'm glad I didn't get what I wanted. You know, I remember really wanting to do this supervisory training up at Minneapolis. So I went before my peers and told them about the situation. And they said, no, Jack, we think you need to be in a situation where your supervisor is your boss. And so I finally said, yeah, I'll go along with the wisdom of the group. And about 3 months later, and I moved to Chicago, about 3 months later, the hospital that I wanted to work in at folded and just went out of business. And then I went to Chicago and this committee said, Jack, you need to get your training where your trainer is your boss. So I took this job in Chicago, and my boss was not the one who would do the training. So I said, how is this going to work out? You know, the guy who's my boss is death on me getting this training. And because I worked in a psych hospital as a chaplain, and the Department of Religion and Health in the general hospital was where the training went. Well, after 2 years there, the psych hospital shrank. My boss lost his job. They took me and put me over in the Department of Religion and Health and said, we want you to get this training. So I didn't have to do anything, but somehow exactly what I needed kind of came. But like I said, I was praying, you know, 2 years prior to that or 3 years prior to that, this is what I want. Please, you know, let's have this. So that's, I guess I'm getting a little bit more clear about, yeah, I can ask for things, but I'm needing to be more patient about how it comes about and things like that. So, but that's an area that I feel, I don't know, I got a lot of feelings about it, you know. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I deal with a person's mentality sometimes, who says, I'm not supposed to ask for anything.
Yeah.
You know, if you live in a parsonage, and you always have to go back and ask a church council for this yeah. and for that. And I just wonder if it's not just that, sometimes people are afraid to ask God for what they want. I think generally, the general populace sometimes, especially those of us who, quote, are raised Christian, think we don't deserve what we want to ask for. Yeah. I just wonder if you want to comment on that.
Well, what comes to my mind is, I think part of what's difficult is I don't always really know what I want.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, I think as I'm getting more mature and more have more experience and I understand what is my heart's desire, I think that helps too. Because there's a lot of things I thought that I wanted that I'm glad I didn't get. And, you know, in part it's I just didn't know myself well enough. So that would also be a part of it. But I think your comment about the message, you know, we're not supposed to ask, that was one of my family messages. Because I think my parents had difficulty saying no. So rather than saying no, they'd say,
don't ask.
Yeah, you shouldn't ask that. They ask, that's a selfish thing to ask. I mean, they never say it like that, but I mean, I think that's the, as an adult, and I, you know, and then being a parent myself, you know, you really wish your kids wouldn't ask some of those questions. So I have a little different perspective on why they might have kind of given me that message. So maybe that's a part of it. Does anybody have a pen? I'm sitting here thinking your feedback's important, and then I don't have anything to write it down on. I guess I can listen to my tape again. Yeah. Any other questions or comments? I want to leave it open now. I'm not sure how we're doing for time, but someone tell me the time. I'll...
I have 40.
It's about 22. Okay.
I know. For me, when I was never taught that I couldn't ask, but I was always taught, and I really do believe that it's true what it talks about in 1 John chapter 5, 15 verse, that it's not whatever I ask for I can have, that is whatever I ask for that's according to His will. And that's what I get stuck, is I'm not always sure whether or not what I want is in alignment with God's will for me. And so a lot of times I find in my prayers that I'm praying that He'll reveal to me whether or not what I'm asking for is in alignment with His will. And if it's not, if He'll help me to see that and to change my desire. He has, and it has given me a lot more confidence in my praying, because there have been times where when I was praying and I would be like almost there, and there'd be like this one little piece that I had that was a criteria, you know, that the way that I thought it should look. And it took, the waiting period was the period where God helped me to see that, yeah, this is something I really want you to have, but I just need you to figure out this piece. And when He helped me to figure out that piece, then it happened. So that has become a really important piece for me, remembering that when I asked that it should be according to His will. Because He promised that, Jesus said that if anything that I ask in His name, that, well, what does that mean? To me, that means that if it's in His name, He's gonna be in agreement with it, because I wouldn't sign my name to something that I'm not in agreement with.
That's good.
So that it's been real helpful.
He's got to sign off, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. See, you're helping me with the last piece of this presentation. Other responses to what we've talked about in a general way, or other things that you've experienced as a barrier, or other observations? Yeah.
I noticed when you were talking about your prayer life, you said you didn't pray as a child. I wonder, did other people pray as a child?
I did. Mm-hmm.
Is that sort of the norm? I'm speaking about not prayers that we're taught to repeat, but petitions that come from our that are original.
Raise your hands if you did, if you were kind of mindful of that.
No.
Two, three. Okay.
I was taught the prayers that you pray in rote first.
Yes. Yes.
But I was taught to add to that. They always left a part, you know, to do. Not let me down to sleep, you know, that. Yeah. But they always had me to add.
Well, then you add pray for mom.
And
also a litany.
Yeah, and that was how I began to think about prayer.
I think my parents tried, but I just don't think it clicked. I mean, so I don't want to say they didn't do their part, but.
So, sometimes we make assumptions about other people's lives, generalizing on our own, and then we're so wrong. So when you said that, I thought, oh, didn't everybody pray as a child?
Oh, I think that's what the message when someone said there was an assumption behind my presentation. I think somebody wanted to say, some of us pray. Yeah.
I find it difficult praying out loud in a group. I don't mind to myself, because I figure that if it doesn't come out right, God still understands what I'm trying to say. But I find it very difficult trying to express what I'm thinking or feeling or in a group context, and that frightens me. Mm-hmm. And it keeps me from doing that, which is not a good thing, but that's a barrier for me.
Why do you say it's not a good thing? What do you think?
Because I think it's prayer can be more powerful if it's in some ways, if you have more people that are kind of with you, depending on what the prayer may be about. If it's about if you're in a Bible study, and it might be about a friend or someone that everyone sort of knows, and they're all sort of with you. In some cases, it also, if you say some of your prayers, your concerns out loud, it's a way of getting support or for other people to know what's going on, and that in itself can be maybe an answer too. Mm-hmm. If you're having difficulty in some area, it's so that other people know where you're coming from. But if you just keep it all inside, mm-hmm. Then you don't have the chance, or your other community doesn't have a chance to work with you.
I'm going to say just a couple things. One is Romans 8:26 is really a powerful passage for me. And when we don't know how to pray as we should, the Holy Spirit intercedes for us with sighs and groans too deep for words. So that I'm convinced that even when I take my last breath, that's going to be a prayer. That God knows me better than I know myself, and knows my needs, and lets me off the hook so that if I'm in a public situation, I mean, let's face it, ministers are public prayers, and we do that, we've been trained, we've been taught, and hopefully we can do it halfway acceptable to the rest of the people, but the whole groaning and sighing too deep for words says that it's more than just a verbal communication. It's a splunk night. It's a gut flame that God knows and God sees what I need. Saying, and it comes from the world of chemical dependency. There are times when I'm just moved to thank God for everything. The beauty of the chemically dependent world is. Thank God I'm such a lousy drunk, because if I wasn't, I wouldn't have known the serenity now, and I wouldn't have known the grace of God. So the ability, and I think that's Philippians 4, I've known what it's like to be in plenty, and I've known what it's like to be in want, and I can do all things through Him who strengthens me. Just that attitude of gratitude that so often is missing in my life, where I just need to do a gut check and say, man, what are you doing, Vuka? Just slow down and thank God for what you have, rather than concentrating on what you don't have.
Yeah, I think gratitude is, it's a big one. And for me, it's different than positive thinking about things. It really is looking for the good in things. Okay, well, I'll certainly stick around, and because I'm on dish team and I want to avoid going up there. I want to be able to come in and say, boy, I tell you, great session, got things hopping, sorry I'm late. But thank you very much, and this has been very helpful. I think I got a little another, point to make. It was good to have the opportunity to share, my experience. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.